Workplace psychological safety is the most pressing need we have today. But do you have the tools to transform a toxic workplace into a psychologically safe one? We have a course for that. It is called From Tormentor to Mentor, Building a Psychologically Safe Workplace. With this self-study 3-hour online course, you can equip yourself and your organization to understand workplace bullying and harassment. More importantly, our course shows you how to build a foundation for a safe and healthy workplace using the SWELL principle: safety, well-being, encouragement, and learning. Elimination of bullying will only work if a foundation of psychological workplace safety has been intentionally built and maintained. Go to shiftworkplace.co/tormentor2mentor to learn more. That's shiftworkplace.co/tormentor2mentor. Hello, Culture and Leadership Connections listeners. Today, I am really excited to present to you my guest. Her name is Madam Salah Ward, a Juris Doctor, a business architect, a Black Lives Matter and women's rights activist. Some people know her as the former notorious attorney during Black Lives Matter, who defied the system, or one of the top female slam poets in the world. I'm hoping she's going to do a little slam poetry during our podcast today, or the professional troublemaker for the National Organization for Women, the largest women's organization in the world. People that have heard her speak in person know that this wasn't always her story. Before she became Salah Ward, Juris Doctor, she was Caramel the sex worker. When you hear her speak live, she tells an addictive story of resilience and how you can be your own superhero, even when the world thinks you're a villain. People have seen her on TLC's reality TV show, She's in Charge, on CNN, C-SPAN, BET, and on the stage of the March for Women's Lives, the largest march in the history of the U.S. for its time. But live, you get behind the scenes of the real version of How to Get Away with Murder. Find out how Salah Ward, Juris Doctor, went from bars to bars, yet no bars can break the unbreakable. That is the best bio ever.
Oh, thank you. Not as fun living it as it was writing it.
And that's the best response, too. It's never as fun living it as it is writing about it later. So I am really interested in your story. I'm excited to dig in and find out more about it. Please tell the audience a little bit more about who you are and what you do.
Oh, absolutely. So currently, I am the chair of the International Black Business Agenda. And I also have a business architect firm here in Atlanta, Georgia. A lot of people don't know what a business architect is. So we'll go into that a little bit later. But I've had my business architect firm here since about 2015. Prior to that, I was an attorney. I did business bankruptcy and criminal law. During that time, I was able to free over 300 years of Black lives from the criminal industrial complex. My activism really began prior to becoming an attorney. I worked with the National Organization for Women as their National Field Director for Women of Color. So I would go around organizing protests, demonstrations, civil disobedience around the country and inspiring women and our allies to work together so that we can get political and social changes in our community. But prior to that, I wasn't always the attorney and the activist. I was a sex worker. And that started really early in my childhood from the ages of 12 to 19.
And how did you become a sex worker since you just ended with that? What led to that?
It's a long story. And we have some time today. So I've actually had to do some deep diving in my personal and spiritual learning to really figure out where that came from. On the surface level, you know, my mom, when I was younger, she was addicted to crack cocaine. She was addicted to crack cocaine ever since I was 7 years old. But of course, we don't call them crack addicts or crackheads or anything like that, because I came up with a community where a lot of people was addicted to crack cocaine. We know what the system and what the government did to a lot of Black communities to really immobilize them. We called them rock stars because they were surviving this crack cocaine addiction and they were surviving a lot of the injustice the government put into our community. So we called them rock stars. So I was surrounded by a lot of rock stars. And unfortunately, when I was 11 years old, my mother was shot in a crack cocaine deal that went bad. And she ended up being paralyzed for several years after she was shot. And during that time, I had to move with my grandmother, who was very old at the time. So I was surrounded by a lot of people that, you know, were really big into the drug industry and to the sex work industry and to the crack industry. And I was introduced through that avenue.
So that is not your typical story. And for people who do that have that story, they're not typically going around and telling people about it. What led you to want to talk about this and be public about it?
You know, I didn't tell a lot of people about it either. In all honesty, I had to do a lot of forgiving of myself before I could even talk to other people about it. When I actually first started practicing, I didn't want to tell anybody about it when I started practicing law. Unfortunately, you know, attorney regulation and dealing with the legal community, a lot of times they are very they're investigators. Mm-hmm. So they found out about a lot of my past, you know, before I became open with it myself, because I always had this, you know, this internal fear that people were going to judge me. I learned through a process of just my own self-awareness that one of my biggest challenges in life was building my community or building my family. After my mom was shot in the crack cocaine deal, it felt like, you know, at such a young age that my family was broken up. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I've been really, really trying to rebuild my family back. I ended up moving with my grandmother, so I was separated from my mother and all of my siblings. So, you know, I've been constantly over life trying to rebuild my communities and rebuild my family. So I've had this internal fear, you know, that somehow if people, when I was younger, I would feel like if people knew everything about my past, then they wouldn't love me anymore. You know, that I wouldn't be able to be a part of the family anymore, that I wouldn't be able to be a part of the group. But just going through therapy afterwards, I realized that I had to, you know, tell my story, you know, before everybody else tried to tell my story. Attorney regulation and, you know, the criminal industrial complex, they pretty much was like, you know, we're going to tell your story to the world. Mm-hmm. So I had to just be willing to come forth with it on my own. And that just took me going through therapy and coaching and spiritual development to get okay with it and go through that process of forgiveness.
Yeah, so that you could say it yourself instead of having somebody making up your story in the way that they want to tell it.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, well, that was a really reflective and beautiful answer that you just gave. And it shows how significant it is for healing to take place in one person's life because it affects everybody else around them.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true.
Do you say your family has been in some way, it may be hard to say, but in some way also healed because of your own healing?
Well, you know, I know now, I think that, you know, healing is a lifetime process. So I'm still going through healing on so many different levels. Like I still go through healing with my mother. You know, my mother is still going through her own healing. When she was shot, it sent her through a depression because she couldn't get around and she couldn't be mobile like she was prior to getting shot for a long time. So she, you know, she fell into crack cocaine addiction a lot more after the incident. That caused her to emotionally separate as well from, at least from me. I think her experience with my other siblings was a little bit different, but she separated emotionally from me and she was disconnected quite a bit. So we're still trying to get to the process where we are more open and connected with each other and that we can see the loving essence of each other. So that's going to be a lifetime process. But because I've gone through my healing and I've really, really learned to focus on the tools that are required to heal, it gives me better tools to deal with other people while they're going through their healing and knowing, you know, how to deal with triggers. Like I've become aware of my triggers. So it helps me to be aware of other people's triggers and know how to deal with it a lot more. I have two children now, right? I have a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old. And dealing with them, you know, there's things that I learned when I was growing up that I realized probably wasn't the healthiest. So it allows me to help them to become more in tune with their emotions as well, so that they don't have the same struggles that I did growing up. So I will say that, you know, it's helping me to be proactive in healing with my children. And it helps me to go back and heal some things that weren't healed from my childhood with my siblings and my parents, definitely.
Certainly has helped you to be a more perceptive mother because the self-awareness allows you to see into your own processes and separate that from what your children are doing. A lot of parents don't do that. They just project onto their kids all the time. But I don't think you're doing that from what you just said, you know?
I try not to project on my kids. I have to constantly be aware of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. and noticing what they're doing and why they're doing it as well, and helping them to put a name to it. Once we are able to put a name to our experiences and our emotions, we can manage those emotions a lot better.
That's
so
for sure.
I definitely think that just being able to put a name to it more so, and understanding how my emotions are reactive, is helping me to help them to put a name to their emotions as well.
Awesome. So I know you were born into a family where there's a lot of drugs. You're born into Black culture. And were you in Alabama at that time? Where were you?
I was in North Carolina. I was
in North Carolina.
Near the South, North Carolina.
Yeah. And you were born into these groups, and you're born into other groups too. I mean, you're born into an age group, you're born into your family, you're born into so many different things. Like, from those groups that you were born into, what were some of your influences that have continued to affect you now for your sense of culture and your sense of self as a leader?
I would have to say that when you're in Black communities, I grew up in a primarily Black community, and I was constantly aware of other people that were in my community with me. So I would say, first of all, it was, you know, being Black. And then, you know, second of all, it, you know, was being a Black female, which I think related to some of the choices that I chose in my life later on. One of the things that was really apparent at a very early age was that there was a constant expectation, even from like 6 and 7 years old, that everybody constantly tried to remind me that I was a Black female, and somehow that made me less valuable. And I'm not just even referencing from, you know, white people or non-Black people, even people within the Black community, because we had gone through so much PTSD. And when I say PTSD, I'm referring to post-traumatic slave disorder, not post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right. Joy DeGruy's post-traumatic slave syndrome.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes. So because we had gone through so much PTSD, we were constantly reminded that, you know, we weren't valuable. So we treated each other that way as well. And as a Black female, you know, we were constantly told that, you know, your worth is not as much as some of these other people out here, as much as other females. So that subconsciously put in this desire to everywhere I went to be able to prove my worth. And I do know that, you know, just getting into sex work industry, it was a slow progress that I didn't even realize was happening. Initially, you know, it just came with getting involved with older people that were more mature than me, and, you know, being so afraid that they didn't value me because I had been around so many people that told me that as being a Black female, I wasn't valuable. Making sure that these people were valuing me, you know. So it just started out initially, oh, you know, if they really value you, they would take you out to these type of places, and they would buy you these type of things. They would buy you clothes, you know, or, you know, they would buy you cars, or they would, you know, take you out to fancy restaurants, you know. So, you know, really, really enforcing that with the people that I was interacting with that probably really in the beginning didn't have any other interest than sex with me. But saying, you know, well, you got to do all these things to me so I can make sure that you're valuing me. And then, you know, just being in the sex work industry, you get a lot of people that really just try to hustle you, that really just only want to sleep with you. And if they feel like they can get it for free, or they can get it without paying, or they can get it without doing the work, they will do that. So they'll make you all these promises and say, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this for you. And then you sleep with them, and then they don't do it. You know, they don't follow through with those promises. So that built up the need for me to really, really emphasize that when I was dealing with people, oh, you know, so you, this person back here, did they mistreated me, and they didn't value me, and they didn't give me my worth. So I'm going to make sure now, instead of just trusting you to do it afterwards, I'm going to make sure that you're paying up front. So instead of just having to, you know, do all of these other things for me, like buying me clothes and buying me outfits and taking me shopping, or, you know, taking me out there, instead of doing that, because people have hustled me in the past, now I'm just going to require that you pay me $500 up front, you know, because I want to make sure that I'm getting my worth, and I want to make sure that I'm getting my value. And then after that, it just kind of transcended into me requiring people to pay anytime I had an interaction with them, and being able to use that as my evidence to the world, saying, see, I'm valuable. You know, you guys said that I wasn't valuable because I was Black, and you guys said I wasn't valuable because I was a Black female, or you guys said that I wasn't valuable because I was fat or whatever the case may be. At that point, I thought that I was fat. As an adult, I realized that I wasn't as fat as I thought I was. But, you know, you guys told me I had all of these things reduced my value. But see, this person is willing to pay for me. And that shows that I'm valuable. So I've proved you wrong.
Oh, wow. That is so powerful. I mean, that just that you can identify that and say, this is what it was, you know? How many people in the world also feel that they aren't valuable because they're poor, or they aren't valuable because they can't get a job that pays what they think they're worth? And the way you explained it is so graphic that it just makes it really clear that you are worthy because you are alive on this planet and you were put here for a reason. And those monetary exchanges don't have anything to do with your worth. It's just a false system. But when you, because you realized that, it became a tool for you instead of being a weapon used against you. Is that right? Or am I off on this?
I would definitely say that it was a tool that I used, but over time I had to go, you know, I was expecting as a young person and as a person that came from so many, from a community that really valued itself by what the rest of the world said that we, you know, were worth. Initially, you know, we did look for all of these external things to say that we were worthy, you know, and I think that we still do it, even not even just on a racial level. We tell people in general that your value is based on, you know, what you do in the world. Your value is based on your job. You know, you're only valuable if you're, you know, a attorney. You're only valuable if you're a doctor. You're only valuable, you know, if you make a lot of money, you know. So we have people already, we're raising them to be in this mindset that you're not valuable just for existing. You're not valuable because of who you are. You have to first do something for us, for the world, before we see value in you. And you can't, and it can't just be that you're doing something. You have to do something that we think, you know, deserves a lot of money before we see value in you. So I came up in that community believing that, okay, I have, like, my value is determined by what I do in the world and how much money I make and how much I can get somebody to exchange some type of monetary value for what I'm offering. So I had to really kind of get to the point where I was like, you know what? No, like, I don't have to seek my value in everybody else. You know, I had to seek my value just for existing, just for being me, just for being Salah, just because I woke up and learning gratitude every day for everything, taking everything as a lesson or a blessing, you know, and learning gratitude for everything that I was experiencing and finding value just in that and just in being me. I had to do for myself, what I was expecting the world to do for me in exchange for whatever service I was providing.
That's why I think it's so powerful, because you had a situation that was really difficult and you mastered it in the sense that you played the game so that you could get the most benefit. And it was transactional, more or less. But then you came to a point in your life where you didn't want to make that kind of a transaction anymore because you were worthy and you came to see yourself as being worthy. But you certainly developed some skills as a result. I'll bet you're the best negotiator on the planet.
Yeah, you know, that really did inspire my skills for negotiation. Definitely negotiations and making sure that people are not being taken advantage of, because, you know, especially being young, you know, I thought when I was going through the situation, I thought that I was grown and I thought that I knew everything and I thought that nobody could take advantage of me. But, you know, as an adult, I realized that a lot of the people that I was dealing with probably knew that I was a child and knew that, you know, I didn't know certain things. So I had to grow I had to build up this fence system to make sure that people were not hustling me and not hustling the people around me, because there was other girls also that were involved in the industry. So I became a protector, which I actually had to go through therapy for as well, because I have a tendency to try to rescue other people, which has a lot to do with why I eventually became an attorney, because I wanted to rescue so many other people in my life. I tried to rescue other people from what I wanted somebody to rescue me from. So I was doing for the world what I really wish that somebody would do for me. And then I would develop this anger because nobody did it for me. Like, wait a minute, I'm doing all this stuff for other people. Why isn't nobody doing it for me? You know, until I got to the point where I was able to rescue myself, you know, and understand that everybody is going through their own struggles. Everybody is doing the very best they can. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it did help. It helped me to really become a great negotiator. It helped me to understand what experiences other people were going through and to be able to try to help them to get out of their circumstance. It created the rescuer in me, which I'm working through, because instead of rescuing people, which means I'm going in and I'm doing everything for them, now I'm learning to help people to rescue themselves and to empower them instead of to come in and rescue them.
But you can also see when they are at the point of falling off the cliff, and you're not going to stand there and watch that happen.
Exactly.
If you hadn't developed the rescuing behavior, you wouldn't know that. All of these experiences have really formed you into the powerhouse that you are, really.
Thank you. Thank you. I receive it. I appreciate that.
You transformed the post-traumatic slave syndrome into post-traumatic transformation.
Yes, I love that. I love that. Post-traumatic transformation.
Syndrome. Let's replace all the post-traumatic slave syndromes with post-transformation. Yes. Who would we all be if we were walking around in our transformed and transforming selves?
That's very true. Post-traumatic transformation, because we can't erase the trauma that we've experienced, but we can transform it. So yeah. I love that post-traumatic transformation.
Well, that's what you've been doing. I'm absolutely certain about that. So then now you joined other groups, right? I mean, you didn't just stay in one place. You joined other groups and you learned from those groups and you became a leader in those groups too. And so what would you say you learned from some of those groups that you chose to be a part of? And how has that affected who you are now?
Yes. So I said one of the first things that I learned was actually when I was in the sex work community. And when I was in, dealing with different people in my community that were rock stars, one of the things that I learned was, was my strength and resilience. Like I learned not to be afraid of the word no. That was so, such a journey and so difficult for me to transcend in the beginning, because I was always afraid people weren't going to accept me. They weren't going to love me. They weren't going to be my family anymore. They weren't going to be my friends if they only knew, my history, or they only knew my past, or they only knew what I had experienced previously. But, if you've ever dealt with any type of rock stars in your life before, like I would have like my uncles and cousins and friends, they would come up and they would always give me $5. And I'd be like, no. And they come back the next day, like, you never told them no the previous day. They're like, let me get $5. And I'd be like, I just told you no yesterday. Why are you asking me again? I said no, and then they would come back the very next day, and ask you for $5 again. They would ask you 10 times, 15 times, 20 times, like you never told them no the first 10 times. And I realized that they were not affected by rejection the way that the rest of the world was affected by rejection. That didn't scare them. They still went after what they wanted no matter what. And I realized that if they weren't afraid of rejection, partially, primarily because the world had already placed us at the bottom of the barrel, right? The world had already said that we, were the most rejected people in society as, addicts and prostitutes, drug dealers and criminals. Like we couldn't get any closer to the bottom. When you're already considered the outcast of society, one thing, I talk about is that it allows us to define our own success. It allows us to be our own superheroes and to define what success looks like for us. We can only go up. Being in the community really, really helped me to build my resilience that I needed later on in life. I was told no 999 times when I let the world know that I wanted to be an attorney. They told me, no, you can't. You've been a sex worker. You've had a lot of police contact. You have this history. You're dishonest. People won't trust you. And I had to, come to the realization that no didn't mean that my opportunity was over. No didn't mean that it was the end of the line for me. No just meant that they didn't understand what I was offering them. So even when I was going to law school, I was like, you don't understand what it is that I'm offering you. So let me rephrase the offer so that you understand it a little bit better. And I ended up being accepted to over 25 colleges and universities in undergrad school and over 25 colleges and universities in law school. I even was accepted to the North Carolina School of Science and Math when I was in 10th grade, which is a school that takes like the top 2% from each county. And they put them in college level courses in a college environment. So I was able to transcend past that no and not be afraid of the no and to be comfortable with rephrasing what my offers were, which really helped me in law as well, And then even after I went through law school trying to get licensed as an attorney, I had to go through a special process to prove that I was worthy and that I was honest and that I wasn't a criminal anymore. So they told me no several times, even then, even after I had fought so hard to go through law school and to be accepted to one of the top tier 100 law schools in the country, they still were telling me no. And a lot of times, I did feel like, this is the end of the line for me. My dreams are not going to happen. I didn't think it was possible, but I had to constantly remember that I came from a community that was not afraid of no.
This is so great. You could put that up on your wall, right? I come from a community that's not afraid of no. That's so significant. How many people limit themselves over really tiny no's? Someone looks at them the wrong way and they're out for the next 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Any little thing goes wrong and they can't handle it. And you just keep moving past the no. The no just means maybe, or it means they don't understand it well enough. It means they haven't seen it clearly.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it means.
And you know how to say no and mm-hmm. keep saying no to the things that you're not going to accept.
And one thing that I find also is that people that are afraid of hearing no are often afraid of saying no as well.
Ooh.
And I had that problem growing up also because I was so afraid of hearing no from everybody. There was often times when people would, you know, I do this series. It's called The Fat Whore Entrepreneur.
Who could resist a title like that?
You know, and it talks about how as entrepreneurs, a lot of time we're selling ourselves short because we are devaluing ourselves. So we try to go in and make ourselves cheaper than the next person. You know, and always trying to get people a deal and always accepting what other people offer us instead of finding our own value. And I talk about my experience growing up as, you know, first of all, a chubby Black female sex worker and feeling like my value in the beginning was less than everybody else. So I was always giving deals. I was giving people deals. I would charge a little bit less than everybody else was charging, you know, because I didn't think that I was worthy. I didn't value myself. And in the beginning, that translated, you know, to my other careers, like in law, where I was charging people ridiculously low amounts because I still questioned my own value, even going into law and in some of my business endeavors. And it talks about how a lot of times we tell ourselves no in our head before anybody else in the world tells us no. Like that's the biggest no that we hear is the one that's in our head. And it causes us to reduce our value. Like everybody has a version of themselves that's the prostitute. Everybody does, where they've mm-hmm. sold themselves out, when they've devalued themselves or giving a part of themselves for less than what it was worth, you know, and we see it in every day. That's why so many people are afraid of, they're afraid of tapping into that inner prostitute, that time when they've been that whore in their lives.
I need to take your course. This is really good.
You know, and we go out and we give so many things for free and discounts. And then, you know, we're disappointed in life because we feel like life has not given us what we deserved when we really never even asked mm-hmm. or tried to take what we deserve because mm-hmm. we told ourselves no in our head first.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're articulate, you're smart, you're capable, you can see to the ends of things and move past difficulties and find ways to get healing. Is this like your temperament? Would you say you were born that way? Or, you know, what would you say is particular to what you were born with? And then what did you add on as your personality interacted with the world?
It's so interesting when you ask me if I've always had that or if I was born that way, because as I'm getting older, like I used to speak and talk all the time, even when I was a sex worker, even before that, honestly, like I was always talking. Like I told you, I knew I wanted to be an attorney ever since I was 8 years old. And that came from a play that was I was in third grade. They were having a play in school. And one of the roles was an attorney. And the teacher kept trying to get me to take all of these other roles. And I was like, no. I want to be an attorney. And I had to literally debate her to be able to get this role, you know, and everybody was like, oh my God, you were so good. You know, you like argued just like an attorney, you know, so I've always had that vision. And I think having that vision, even though sometimes my vision was a little weaker at times, really kept me focused on what I knew my divine purpose was or what I thought my divine purpose was at the time. So I've always felt the need to stand up for myself and stand up for others. But like I said, I think some of that came from the rescuer mentality that I've been working through. You know, they say that there's a lot of people that are going through trauma plays one of three roles. Either it's the rescuer, the victim, or the attacker. So I've been in those three roles at different parts of my life. That's what created the attorney and the person that's always debating, person that's always standing up for other people. But now as I get older, like my mind does not work the same way it used to. Like mm-hmm. I was like, man, I used to be able to speak for hours at a time, just, you know, just off the top of my head. And now I have to actually think about what I'm going to say before I say it. And it has nothing, there's no like lesson in this, what I'm just saying, but I do realize that, you know, as I get older, my mind doesn't work as sharp as it was when I was younger.
Maybe it's wisdom.
I hope so.
You know,
is quieter than everything else. So
wisdom's a little whisper in your mind. And sometimes when you listen to it, it makes sense that you maybe don't always speak out, right? Or pick the right person to speak out to.
Yes, I do. Like, I have to write down a lot more things than I used to have to write down. And I used to, in my head, I'm like, I used to be able to just freestyle all of this stuff. Why do I have to write this down now? And sometimes words come out wrong. And I'm like, I know the correct word for it. Why did I just use this other word? You know, sometimes I find myself in the kitchen and I'll go from upstairs to downstairs in the kitchen. And I don't even know why I went in the kitchen. I was like, why am I here? I believe
this is the reality of age starting to kick in. And I'm very sorry to break it to you because you seem to have overcome every other obstacle. But speaking of just speaking off the cuff, do you have one of your spoken word pieces that you would like to share with the audience? I would love to hear it.
This piece is called Walk on Water that I will share with you. Walk on Water is a piece that I actually wrote to my sons to let them know that, you know, we all have to go through trials in our life, and you're going to have to walk on water. You know, you're going to have to get to a place where you're performing a miracle, that you can be that miracle for yourself. He'd be 6. Knee-length jean shorts and a Spider-Man t-shirt, milk and donut powdered smiles, his locks would be shoulder length by now. And I walked 360 miles in his shoes to help him travel through the full cycle of his knowledge, to take his falls when he stumbled, the scratches of life on his knees, the hiccups and his tears. And trust me, there will be. There'll be times when he'll fall to his knees and he can't seem to stop bleeding. He'll hit the most sensitive parts of his funny bones and he won't be able to laugh. He'll twist his ankles in ways that will make him think it's broken. I can hear his gasp for air, trying to make out the words to tell his story, but the salty water keeps pushing them down. Too much a revolutionary to call them tears, exaggerating his tears through his toothless frown, though it's not an exaggeration to him because he feels like it's broken. Mommy, please pick me up. I've fallen and I can't get up. I need you to come get me. And I'll run to him, holding out my arms, holding back my own salty water alarms. And I'll tell him, no, get up and walk. We have all walked on water to get here. Here is where it hurts, through aching ankles, when your arch nemesis becomes the arc of your foot felt detached from a soldier, tiptoeing through the trench landmines of Iraq, carrying another brother soldier on his back, but it was already broken by the bushes that sprouted too thick to see the guns. You better run, nigga, run through wounded windpipes, even when you can't seem to catch your breath. The tsunamis have left your lungs full of bullshit, like Katrina, through lakes of limp and lifeless bodies, left your lungs full of bullshit, like Ike. Crashing through the crevices of Texas felt just like a fist to the face. Could have sworn I heard Trump say, anime, just eat the cake, but didn't Texas walk on water anyway. Then there was Jesus, who came walking on top of the sea. Peter called out to him and said, Lord, if it is you, commanded me to walk. And he said, go now, Peter, step down from the boat. His friends looked on in awe, looked down at the wind and the water, and became afraid of what he saw. Now, Lord, help me, save your child. Jesus stretched his hands out to him and said, why do you doubt? Look back at the water you've treaded and realize you have nothing left to fear now. We have all walked on water to get here. Here is not a poem about religion. Here is a poem about being fearless, because you don't have to be Jesus to turn water into wine. Single mothers do it all the time. We overcome obstacles with each stride when we keep walking. Sister soldiers, keep your guns up. Don't look down and just keep walking, baby boy. When you're hurt, don't stop loving. Don't look down and just keep walking, baby boy. Just keep walking. There's a story in your step. And sometimes life may hurt and not let you tell it yourself, but walk on water. You'll twist your ankles in ways that will make you think it's broken. The tears will come like oceans, but walk on water. Baby boy, America, world, walk your story. Thank you.
Wow. I was just weeping. I had to turn my microphone off.
Oh, man.
It was so beautiful. I can't thank you enough for sharing that.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is amazing. And every time I have conversations like this, like I do go through more and more healing and I get to a better place. And you've given me some jewels today that I'm going to take with me.
That is just really stunning. You are so gifted. And what an honor to have you on this podcast. I still have a couple more questions, though. Let me just reorient myself. I imagine you were experiencing this daily, but can you think of a time when you were aware that your understanding of the world was just you and your culture and not normal? Or was that something you started right from the time you were 7?
It was a long time where I felt like the world, because, you know, first of all, in social media, we're constantly in this echo chamber. And especially with this quarantine, we only hear things that affects us, things that we agree with over and over again. And it will constantly make you think that the rest of the world agrees with you. That similarly happens when you're growing up in a community that's only surrounded by people that look like you. You know, everybody is constantly echoing your sentiments. And you feel like the entire world feels a certain way. And one day you travel and start to go to other places and you realize that people have different opinions. One time when I really experienced that is that I've always had this like fear and anxiety when I would step into a room of white men, especially white older men. I would start to get like a little uncomfortable, or I would feel like something bad is about to happen to me, or I would feel like I'm about to be judged or mistreated, you know? And I realized that maybe that was just people and me and my community, because when I started doing a lot more traveling around the world, especially after I became an attorney and having to deal with a lot of white men and in my profession, I realized that that was not always the case. And what that helped me to realize was that a lot of people are having the experiences that they're having as far as race relationships in this world right now, and not even just race and some other, you know, scenarios as well, because we haven't had exposure and experiences with other people and other cultures and other situations that don't remind us of home, you know? And when we haven't had those personal one-on-one experiences, our fear is based on memories that don't exist. They might be based on memories of what we've heard from other people. They might be based on television. It might be based on what we've heard in the media, but we create fear based on something that we have not personally experienced yet. And a lot of people, you know, right now in this country, they're creating fear based on memories that they haven't experienced. They, you know, they fear Black Lives Matter because, you know, they haven't had experience with a lot of people that are really, really strong in the Black Lives Matter movement, or they haven't had experience with Black females and Black men. And now they have this fear based on a memory from somewhere else, you know, that they haven't experienced. So I feel like the solution, or at least that first step in the solution, is for us to go out and start creating new experiences with each other, creating new experiences with people that don't look like us, that don't sound like us, that don't speak like us. Maybe somebody that speaks a different language, you know, maybe somebody that comes from a different neighborhood, but to go out and create new experiences so that we can build new memories and that we don't have to have that fear anymore.
I so agree with you. Mm-hmm. Totally. You know, it reminds me a little bit of a conversation I had a few years ago with a First Nations woman. She was a teacher in a school. I was doing some workshop or something, and she came up to me and said, "I just want to tell you that beauty is bigger than culture and race." And I said, "You want to explain a little bit more what you mean by that? Because I, you know, you come up to a stranger and you say something like that. What exactly does that mean?" She said, "So, you know, here I was considered to be nothing. I'm a Native woman and people just want to take advantage of me and they don't believe me and they don't trust that I'm worthy and they hate me. But I went to Europe and nobody knew what Native was, and they thought I was beautiful and they thought I was somebody interesting to get to know. And I realized that not everybody in the world sees me that way. And I had a whole new sense of worth just from leaving my country and going on a 2-week vacation."
Yes. I had a similar experience like that also, because, you know, in my community, because I've always been thick. I haven't always been fat, but I've always been thick. And, you know, and here they teach us that, you know, that's a horrible thing. And then I went to Italy And they were so like infatuated with the fact that I was thinking, it was like, oh my God, this is so beautiful. I was like, really? you think it's beautiful? Okay. And I did some traveling to some different countries in Africa also, and they was very similar. And I was like, oh, okay. So it's the people around me that are telling me that I'm ugly. You know, also like if I just go outside of my circle, you know, then I can get some new experiences. That's on a very like service level. But I absolutely agree with that, that we just have to, sometimes we have to go outside of our circles to be able to experience what real beauty is. And I'm not just talking about on a visual level, but internally as well, to be able to experience those other aspects of beauty.
Yeah, to see beauty where beauty is and to appreciate it is a spiritual experience. So we're reaching the end of this interview. What's the best way for people to work with you? How do they bring out the best in you? And how does that be a relationship that's really mutually beneficial?
So the best way to reach out to me initially is my website, www.ninavafirm.com, ninavafirm.com. And then that can give you kind of a basis of what we do as a business architect firm. You can also reach me on social media anywhere. So my Instagram is Salah Ward and my Facebook is Salah Ward's fan page. So Salah spelled a little bit differently. It's NSELAAWARD. The N is silent, so everybody ends up spelling it wrong. So you can reach me there to work with me on a deeper level. I have a program, and it's just, you know, a quick bullet point list that we deep dive into deeper on just on a race basis. So it's called the 8-step method to preventing misplaced fear. And it basically talks about 8 things that we can do based on the acronym MISPLACE instead of calling the police on people of color, especially businesses. Right? Because businesses, they have a tendency to resort to the police even more so than individuals a lot of times. And we all know that right now in this country, calling the police can mean a death sentence for a lot of people of color. So if people like to get access to that, then they can text me. It's a US-based number, and it'll automatically send them a link to the document, the 8 steps to prevent misplaced fear. So that text number is 404-410-0200, 404-410-0200. And it'll send them a link to that document so that they can really work through that in their own communities. So just to give you a little bit of information about a business architect, what we do is that we go in and work with small to medium-sized businesses to help them to take their small business to an enterprise level, right? A lot of times we call it going from hustle to enterprise. And that's 10 pillars of an enterprise. So we go in and we do an audit of their company to see where the leaky holes are, to see where they lack systems, to see where they lack infrastructure. And we go in and we co-CEO with them, right? So this is not just a situation where we're coaching you and you're doing it yourself. This is a situation where we're coming in and we're working with you as your partner on your business. We are rebuilding those 10 levels, those 10 pillars, so that you can have a strong infrastructure within your company. A lot of people, you know, we've been told this misconception that everybody has the same 24 hours in a day, right? So they make us feel incompetent when our 24 hours don't look like Beyonce's 24 hours. And the reality is that our 24 hours is a little bit different because Beyonce has a business architect or a business manager that's working on her team that's building the infrastructure for 100 other people to work on her business, right? So when we compare our 24 hours to her 24 hours, it's not going to be the same because she has a team that's working with her. A lot of times as entrepreneurs, we're wearing so many different hats, a thousand different hats, trying to be the customer service, trying to do sales, trying to do marketing, trying to do human resources, trying to do fulfillment, you know, trying to do every aspect of our business. And we end up being mediocre in everything because we're spreading ourselves too thin. So bringing a business architect is coming in and helping you to design the infrastructure as well as building the team so that you're not doing it by yourself, right? So initially we're building the infrastructure from the moment that you walk into the door, from the moment somebody sits down, turns on the light, flips the light to the end process where they are closing out a customer and eventually making them a repeat customer. So we build that model for you so that anybody that's qualified can come in and work in your business so that you don't have to be the one that's always there, right? And we're doing it with systems that already have proven success so that you're not constantly reinventing the wheel. And then the second thing that we do is we go in and we build your team so that you're not doing everything on your own so that you can actually have an authentic enterprise and not just a hustle. Also, one of the things is that that's a little bit different than other business architect firms is that most of our clients are trying to be thought leaders in the industry, or they are thought leaders in the industry. The difference between a thought leader and an expert, a lot of people say, you know, I'm an expert in my industry. I'm a specialist in my industry. An expert can actually go in and teach you how to do something. And they'll say, you know, you do A, B, and C, and you get to D. A thought leader is somebody that will come in and make you think differently about the work that you're doing, right? They'll make you think in a different way. So a lot of the people that we are working with are people that are also trying to be thought leaders in their industry. So we take them on tour around the country and even right now around the world since coronavirus, because we could do things digitally, so that everybody can see their expertise and see them as thought leaders. So we take them on tours in colleges and universities, as well as conferences and corporate events around the country and around the world right now. And then the third thing that we do that we've learned from the coronavirus epidemic is that we help them create a digital stream of revenue. Right now, you know, a lot of people have historically always felt like, you know, if it's not a brick and mortar business, then it wasn't a real business, right? We've learned that that was a lie, right? Maura told us that that was a lie. Everybody is working from home right now, but people don't really have the infrastructure to know how to do it efficiently. So we go in and make sure that even if you are a traditionally brick and mortar business, or even if you are a service-based business that has to work directly with your customer, that you always have a digital stream of income and revenue so that your business can always operate at maximum capacity. And that can look like different things. That could be a course, that can be an app, that can be a subscription box, that can be a membership site. There's a lot of different things that can build that digital stream for you. But we go in and analyze your business to determine which would be the best avenue.
Wow. Sign me up.
All right.
It just sounds so good. Why would anyone say no to that? That's just super. So I will put all of that stuff into the show notes so people can hear it and see it and find it and make sure they can find you. Anything else you'd like to say before we end our interview today?
That's all. I would love for people to reach out and connect with me. Text me on the number and I'll send you the 8 steps, 404-410-0200. And I'd love to see you guys on social media. And I'm open for more connections and more relationships.
Awesome. Salah Ward, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I feel honored to have been entrusted with Salah Ward's precious and powerful story. From a childhood of abuse and neglect, Salah Ward was able to arise like a phoenix from the sex work she was forced into by her own grandmother, to becoming an attorney and successful business owner. Her confidence, built from the bottom up, proves that there is no fear we cannot overcome and no trauma that cannot be transformed. If you seek a story to burst you out of your comfort zone and open the windows to the depth and breadth of human experience, this is the podcast episode for you. Words fail me as I try to encapsulate even a small measure of the power in this exchange with Madame Salah Ward. I hope that we are all transformed as a result of hearing her story. As always, the best way to thank the Culture and Leadership Connections team for continuing to produce this podcast is to share it. I wish you a most insightful week. And may Culture and Leadership Connections continue to guide and inspire your day. This podcast would not be possible without the expertise of our Culture and Leadership Connections production team. A big thank you and shout out to Mike Kurlander for audio production and editing, to Malvika Kathpal for the show notes, Bernadette Guadiz for online web and social media management and promotions, Celine Bayogo for design, and Kirsten Hoyer for website and branding. Thank you so much. Hey, Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners. Do you love these insightful and moving interviews published twice monthly for your listening pleasure? You may not know that it costs between $300 and $500 per month to pay for our podcast episodes. Shocking, but true. Well, now you can help support this podcast by showing your love with a little skin in the game real money on the Patreon website. For as little as $5 or as much as $50 a month, you can contribute to keep Culture and Leadership Connections alive and healthy. Your donation is invaluable in helping us connect the hearts and minds of people across cultures and professions for happier and more humane workplaces. I know you will call on your inner generosity, knowing that your contribution is a practical demonstration of love and support. Check out the patreon.com/culture and leadership connections page to see what subscription level feels right for you and find out about the special loyalty perks at each patron level. That's spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com/cultureandleadershipconnections. Thank you for your generosity.